Session number 10597, Reel 5.
Mr. Masters, Reel 5.
That one set was based on a Lancaster. It had Lancaster engines, Lancaster wing, but the fuselage was a square section, and we could carry about 26 passengers. It was really an interim aircraft before they could develop proper passenger aircrafts again, aircraft again after the war. We used to go from I was on the Singapore run, and we would do that in 5 days, but all day flying, have a day off in Singapore, turn around and come back again. But then when we got onto the airlift, we didn't carry many passengers. It was all coal and flour and such things as that.
How exactly was it organised then?
Well, initially, when we got out there, we reported to the operations room, and I said, right, there's an aircraft on the airfield, such and such an aircraft, which is loaded, take that one. So we leapt into it, dropped the load into Berlin, came out again. Any more aircraft? Yes, there'll be another one ready for you. Go and take that one. And it was a bit haphazard to start with. It was sort of first come, first served, and they were getting as many aircraft as they could into Berlin without any sort of real organisation. When I say real organisation, it's not fair to say that, without without the sort of organisation that was eventually developed. A flight lieutenant navigator happened to say in the coffee room one day, "They could run this airlift like a bus service." So I used to work on the buses, and you know, we had a proper timetable. And a senior RAF officer said, "If you're so clever, present one for me," which he did, and that was used from then on. During this period, in the organised period, we would be given definite stages to work to. We would be on early morning shift, midday, or a night shift. I can't remember precisely the times it started. It was something like 4:15 in the morning we would go on, and we might be working till 8 or midday or 2 o'clock or something like that. Then the afternoon shift would come on, then they would work until sort of the evening, and then a night shift would come on until the early morning shift again, and so this kept going on. Now when you went on for your shift, you reported to the operations room. The controller would give you a slip of paper with your aircraft time, aircraft number, position, the time that you could start up, the time you had to taxi, the time you had to take off, and then the time to be at each individual beacon on the route into Berlin. You want more detail about the actual routing in? Well, now when as you were approaching a particular beacon, you called out over such and such a beacon, whatever the name of the beacon was, 15 seconds early. Another navigator in the section behind would say, over such and such a beacon, maybe he's 10 seconds early. So, right, you're 15 seconds early, he's 10 seconds early, so you are ahead of him. The navigator in the section in front of you would hear that you were 15 seconds early, and he would check on his time, and he would find out maybe it was 20 seconds early, so that was all right. But if I was early and he was late, he would have to increase his speed to get to the beacon at the right time. I would have to listen to what his time interval was going to be, and I would have to adjust my time so not to catch up with him. Ideally, we should all be at the beacons at precisely the same time.
So you were as close together as that?
Oh, yes. We were 3 minutes apart. Then, as we approached Berlin, we would have the Skymaster and a Dakota, RAF Dakota, drop in between us, and then the Skymaster and Dakota drop in between us behind, and so on, all the way down. And then we would be landing at Gatow at 1 minute intervals.
Where had the Skymaster and Dakota come from?
The Dakotas had come from Lübeck. Where had the Skymasters come from? Do you know, I really can't remember now. It was north, north Germany.
Point.
Oh yes, yes. There were three different supply points. The Yorks came from
Flensdorf.
RAF Dakotas came from Lübeck, and then the Americans came from somewhere else.
And over Berlin, you all had to dovetail together.
Yes, that's right. On into the final beacons. Then we would call, if I remember correctly, it was over the Fraunhofer, serviceable or something like that.
It was what?
We'd call over the Fraunhofer, which is a beacon called the Fraunhofer.
How do you spell that?
Fraunhau.
And what was the name of the airfield you were landing at in Berlin?
Gatow. That is Gatow.
So it really had to be finely timed.
Oh, very.
That's
right, yes. Now, if you missed your approach, you had to go back to base, you know, back to Wunstorf again, or wherever you came from. You would not be allowed to go around again. You either made it or you didn't.
Did that ever happen to you, where you had to go back?
No, no. We were always very fortunate. In the early days, a controller, before we got into this organised system, a controller lost his nerve and went off his head, and they had to take him away.
Because it was finely judged?
Yeah, and one of the pilots from Lynham took over control from the air. Controlled the aircraft onto the ground.
Do I understand you to say that this system was actually adopted as a result of the suggestion of this chap who'd been in the bus service?
Yes.
In London?
Well, I don't know where he was, but he'd been in a bus service somewhere.
Do you know his name?
No, I can't remember that now.
But he was in your squadron?
No, he wasn't on our squadron, but he was from Lynham. I think it was from Lyme, sorry. There was another squadron from Abingdon. It was also Yorks. There.
Once you got down...
Yes.
...at Gatter, how were you handled then?
Well, the unloaders would be there immediately, and while they were unloading the aircraft, we'd go across to the toilets and sell our coffee and cocoa and chocolate to the black market, and then go to the Malcolm Club and have our cups of coffee.
To which club?
Malcolm Club.
How do you spell that?
Malcolm, M-A-L-C-O-L-M.
And so obviously there had to be an efficient system on the ground handling the aircraft.
There was, very efficient. The unloaders would be into the aircraft, you know, our freight doors would be up, we'd have open the freight doors, and they'd be into the aircraft, the lorry would be backed up against the freight doors, and we would have to get past them while they were actually unshackling the load, because our load was all netted, you know, with webbing straps. Initially it was just tied down, but this was too dangerous, and they introduced the nets.
Webbing straps?
Webbing, big webbing nets, yes.
Like army webbing?
Yes, with big buckles on and sort of quick release, so they could take this net off and get at the freight.
And what was this black market stuff that you had?
Oh, chocolate and things like that, which the Germans wanted to buy.
English chocolate?
Yes, it was English chocolate.
And so the teddy bears.
That's right.
What were the teddy bears?
Huh?
What teddy bears were these?
Oh, I bought the children some teddy bears with the proceeds of this. But I had no compunction whatsoever in dealing with the German black market from what they'd taken from me during the war. So that didn't bother me at all.
What type? You were getting money for it, were you?
Oh, yes, yeah. Well, then we'd buy things with it, you know, to bring home.
So it wasn't a barter system?
No, no, it wasn't a barter system. There'd be a straight price. And
what type of prices would they pay for a bar of chocolate?
I think about equivalent to about 6 shillings or something like that. You know, for a little bar of chocolate.
Who were the Germans who were buying from you, though?
Anybody. They were mostly unloaders. But they would take that chocolate and get a much better price for it in Berlin. But one day somebody came up to one of the pilots and said, have you got any chocolate to sell? Yes, he said, but to a German. He said, I am a German. Don't talk rubbish. He said, you're a service policeman dressed up as a German. He said, your accent is even wrong. So I said, no, I'm going to sell it to the Germans. He said, you're telling me that? And he said, you think I'm a policeman? Where are you going to sell it? He said, don't worry. He said, when I come back, he said, I'll have the money, but I won't have the chocolate.
And it was a service policeman?
It was a service policeman, yes.
Trying to catch him.
Mm. But you know, we heard, but we have no verification of this, that some of the freight that we were taking in was being stolen and being sold on the black market. No, you know, that was dreadful.
Did you think it's true?
Yes, I do. Well, we think that some of the service personnel were responsible for this as well.
You mentioned flour and coal.
Mm-hmm.
What else were you bringing in?
Oh, all sorts of food. I can't precisely remember what it was. I know they wanted to take us to take some hay for the general's horse on one occasion.
Did you?
No, we didn't. This caused a bit of upset because we went down to the aircraft and there was a soldier with a great big bundle of hay outside the aircraft, and we'd heard something about this hay for the general's horse. You see, what's all this? And we looked in the aircraft and it was stacked right up to the roof and within about 6 inches of the side of the aircraft, and there was just a few feet left to go. So my skipper said to the soldier, what are you doing? I'm loading this aircraft. Yes, well, how do we get in? Not my problem. He said, get in through the front windows. So the skipper said, well, what is this? He said, how much hay have you got to put in this aircraft? We said, I've only got a quarter of it in yet. And you know, most of it was outside. The skipper said, do you really think you're going to get that in that space? I don't know. Well, it was quite obvious that he wasn't going to. So the skipper said, well, that's not a safe aircraft for us to fly, and you can unload it. The soldier said, do you know what time I started work this morning? So my skipper said, no, I said, I don't really care. He said, 6:30 this morning. So the skipper said, do you know what time we started? 4:15. Get that aircraft unloaded. And that was the only time we ever had anything to do with the general's hay.
Did you have any other contact with the Berliners apart from your selling the chocolate and so on?
No, not then, no. No, because we would go in, unload, well, we'd have a coffee while we'd be unloaded, then take off back to base.
Did you hear anything of the plight they were in?
Of the plight? We knew that they were in pretty poor straits. And anybody who'd been a POW need not have gone there. We were told we could go back. But I think we realised that, you know, that we couldn't possibly leave the people to starve, because that's what was happening. And one day a German said to me, this was at Wunstorf, he said, we feel sorry for you people. You know, it was during the winter, sitting up there in the cold. I said, well, don't worry about us, we're quite warm in the aircraft. You know, it's worse for you perhaps on the ground in this winter, you know, with the shortage of fuel. So I said, funny you're concerned about us now. I said, not so long ago we were trying to kill each other. So he said, that's life, isn't it? which it was. That was a feeling we had. Feeling I had, I can't say for other people.
Did the Russians or East German authorities try to interfere with you at all?
The Russians? Yes, they did. Oh. Well, on more than one occasion, I've been into Berlin with a Russian fighter escort. They would get above us, and as we flew past an air-to-ground firing range, they would dive past us, very close indeed, and we got the impression they were firing at the range, which was right on the edge of the corridor. But all we just do is that they went past, we waved to them. But we weren't so worried about that. We'd even have them ahead of us and behind us, you know, like a proper fighter escort. But the time that we were concerned was my skipper called me up one day and he said, come and look at these two. And there were two Russian fighters, wingtip to wingtip, at our height, coming straight at us. So I said, well, what are you going to do? He said, nothing I can do. He said, if I go down, they might. If I go up, they might. So he said, we just have to wait. And at the last instant, they broke. And they went past our wingtips. And the engineer was down in the fuselage, and he came up shaking like a leaf. And he said, I've just seen a Russian fighter go past the starboard wing. Did you see it? I said, no, I was looking at the one that went past our port wing at the same time. Don't joke with me. I said, we had two Russian fighters just come head on at us. So he said, find out where they've gone. I said, what do you want me to do, shoot them down or something? But he was terribly upset.
Any other ways they harassed you?
Yes, we used to see artillery fire on the ground because there was an artillery range between the two corridors, but that was no, I suppose, real harassment. It was always just the possibility that we were in danger, but whether we were or not, I don't know. There were stories of Russian target towers flying in the corridor and such things as that, but if we saw them, we'd turn towards them and try and frighten them, which we did. And they used to frighten them and they'd dive for the ground and disappear. But I think that we possibly caused as much harassment to the Russians, because when we were taking off westbound to come back from Gatto, we climbed to about 200, 300 feet as though we were taking off normally, and then once we were clear of the airfield we would level out, and then when we got to the German barracks we'd come down slightly, wait till we were over the centre of the barracks. The pilot would put the propeller pitched to fully fine, full throttle, and he'd say, right, when do I climb? So the navigator would be leaning at the Bristol window, right, you're over the centre, now. And he'd sort of pull up, and they get the full blast of this from about 200 feet. Well, 1 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the morning wasn't too funny for the Russians. And we do this during the daytime as well, you see, but we said, well, one of these days they're going to put an anti-aircraft gun up here and shoot us down. But on one occasion, I remember this very clearly, we were coming over the barracks, and I said to the skipper, there's a big parade going on. He said, yes, I can see. And a band was playing, and all the generals or whoever they were, and there was massive...
What was that?
Saw one of these officers with masses of gold braid and his entourage behind him inspecting the troops. The band was playing, and we got over the middle of this lot, and I said, no, and the skipper pulled the stick back, and I saw the band put their instruments down, and this man with all the gold braid shaking his fist at us as we went away, and we were sure that we'd get some retaliation from that, but nothing ever happened.
Did you think that the airlift might not succeed?
No, I didn't ever think that.
You were confident in
that? Oh, yes, yes. Because the people seemed to be quite happy to be fed by us. And the Russians just couldn't have kept it up for long. They thought that we would give in. But they eventually opened up the roads again and canals and whatever, and the railways. So we carried on with the airlift, much as to say, well, so what, we don't care about your blockade. But we were then building up a store in case they put it on again. I got a bit concerned one night when I heard two civilian navigators in the next sections ahead of me. One called up and said that he was a minute late on the beacon, and the other one said he was 15 seconds early. And a bit later on, the first navigator said he was a minute and a half late, and the other one was still early. Then I had a little discussion, and this was all done in cloud at night, pitch black. And then one navigator said, I've passed you. And we were all precisely at the same height, and I went in the next section, and I thought, what is going on? And I mean, you couldn't turn out of the corridor and go back to clear them. I didn't know quite what was happening, and then suddenly I heard the original navigator say, ah, I understand, my watch has stopped. So, you know, they made the timing for them completely haywire. But what happened to them, I just don't know, because I never did find out who it was. But we had another remarkable incident one night. We were going in, and it was so crystal clear, you could see for miles. You know, I've never seen it before like it, and I haven't ever seen it since. And it was so clear that as we turned into the airfield, Skipper said to me, where's the airfield? Where's the runway? I said, it's ahead of you. He said, I can't see it. There's a mess of lights down here. And I had to switch my radar on to line him up with the runway before he could actually see it. Well, then we took off, and we were going back on the southerly route. And we were just clearing the area, and suddenly the skipper said, my God, there was a Skymaster nearly hit us then. I said, well, where was that? He said it was coming from the opposite direction. So I said, well, he's way off course. Then we heard an American call up. He said, hello, Gatto. He said, where are you? So Gatto said, we're down here. Where are you? He said, I'm up here. But where? He said, over a lot of lights. They said, do you know who you are? He said, no. This must be Berlin, I guess. And then after a while, he said, hey, Gatto, he said, I'm running out of lights. Oh, do you know where you are? No. So my skipper called up, and he called this American. He said, did you nearly hit a York just now? Yeah, goddamn, he said, I'm sorry. He said, was that you? I'm ever so sorry. So he said, well, stand by. He said, my navigator will give you a course back to Gatto. I said, no, I will. He said, yes. He said, you know roughly the heading he was on because the angle he crossed us. You know the time. You know his speed. So now work out a position for him. Which I did. And gave it to him. And we heard him actually come back to Gatto and say, yes, he picked up the runway. But a very grateful American, because he was completely lost. What he had done, he'd come across from the northern bound or the inbound corridor, and crossed right across the East German section. We had a rather strange incident one night when we'd come back to Wunstorf, and we just touched down, and I did a very wrong thing. I took my safety straps off. I'm preparing to pack my bag to get out of the aircraft while we were still rolling. I suppose we were doing about 65 knots at the time. And then I felt the aircraft going down. I thought, this is odd. The undercarriage is collapsing. And the skipper pressed the RT button. He called up the tower. He said, undercarriage collapsing. But this time I got my straps on again. And I thought, when these props hit the ground, you know, a bit's going to fly off and hit me. But didn't see the props hitting the ground, but we were going further and further down. Then I heard a horrible scraping noise. I got a smell of burning. What's going on? Skipper said, I don't know. Then it felt as though we were getting airborne again, and I thought we were going up in the air and going to turn over on our back. and then there was a big bang, and I realised what had happened, that we had, as we landed, we had tipped up on our nose and were running along on our main wheels and our nose, and we rubbed off for the radar aerials, and that was the smell of burning, you know, with the radar shorting out. And the bang was when the tail wheel came back on the ground again. So that was a very strange experience, because we didn't know, you know, we'd lost, it was an uncommon occurrence, so we couldn't interpret it. Anyway, we got back to the ground crew hut, and there was a big argument going on, and one of them said to the skipper, "Oh, sorry," he said, "settle an argument for me." He said, "Have you ever seen a York up on its nose?" The skipper said, "Why should you ask that?" Well, he said, "Flight sergeant over there said that he's seen a York up on his nose," and he said, "I say it's impossible." So the skipper said, "Well, I think you'd better go out and have a look at our aircraft," he said, "because you've got to repair ours." "What?" he said, "Are you serious?" "Yes, we are, you know." And it's, but we said, "Have you just been, do you know what's happened to us?" I said, no, this was an entirely independent argument, you know, that it couldn't be done. "No, you've done it." And what had happened, we discovered that there was a slight hump in the runway. Whether we got a slight following wind or not, I don't know. But they had been taking a lot of stuff out of the aircraft to get more freight in. And I think they cleaned the galley out, and the centre of gravity was right on the main wheels, and as we were braking and beginning to go downhill, so it was enough just to tip us over. Oh, that was another little incident. But then there was a Lancastrian flight refueler that came in to land one day. We weren't at Berlin at the time, but we knew that the airlift had been postponed through an accident. And what had happened, this Lancastrian had something like 2,500 gallons of fuel in its tanks, you know, for flight refueling. Made a heavy landing and bounced about 40 feet. And the engineer looked out and he said to the skipper, "Right, the next time you touch the ground," he said, "that'll be your last time ever." "Why is that?" He said, "because the undercarriage is smashed." Oh. So anyway, they called up the tower and said, "You know, they're crashing." And I spoke to the controller afterwards about this incident. He said, "I looked out and I saw the aircraft hit the ground, and I said it was doing about 30 knots, and I was waiting for it to blow up." And he said, "Suddenly bodies started coming out of the aircraft, you know, it's at 30 miles an hour, and they were running." So he said, "How they managed it, I don't know." And immediately the aircraft stopped, it blew up, blew the windows out of his tower. And he said, "I grabbed hold of the phone to ring the mortuary to